Hi, this is Brian Gale. Welcome to our recourse on a steamy Monday in June, June 12. It's 96 outside the studio. Don't know where it is where you are. I hope you're cool wherever you are. We have a wonderful show for you today. We're going to kick it off with Mike McMonagle, a great pro-life leader. I say great because he's been at it a long time. He's got a long list of credits and achievements, including the scars to prove it. But he's a leader locally. He's a leader regionally. He's even a leader nationally. And he runs the Family Life Educational Foundation, and they have an annual golf outing each year. This year, it's at June 26th. It's Stonewall, beautiful country club, golf club out in Chester County. Half the proceeds from the event go to Gen Life. We'll talk about that. The other half goes to the foundation, and they use it in various ways to help save babies, promote the cause of life. Mike's here to talk about the event and the causes that it benefits. Mike, welcome and thank you.
Good afternoon, Brian. Thank you for having me and promoting our organizations through this golf event.
Tell us about the event itself. I see that it's Monday, June 26th at Stonewall. I see that there's the typical marathon golf dimension to it. There's a single round foursome. People can play 500 and play 18 holes, pay 500 and play 18 holes, or 2,000 for a foursome. 1 o'clock tee off. There's platinum event sponsorships at 10,000 and gold events at 5. There's award sponsors 2,500. There's a whole sponsor at 1,000, a food sponsor at 500. Malvern's in for that one. Cart sponsor 200, a friend of life for 100. You can support a golfer. You can support the mission in many and myriad other ways. You've got an outstanding committee of people, a number of whom I know, working at this. Tell us a little bit about the event and the causes that it benefits.
Oh, yeah, thank you. The event is a great day for the cause, and it's fun for those who participate. We begin with 7 a.m. Mass. It's traditionally been celebrated by Father Joe Coffey, a veteran participant, but Father Joe is a Navy chaplain currently literally out to sea on the USS Carl Vinson. His mentor, Monsignor McBride, will join us, as will Father Jason Buck. And then we have a first round of golf kicks off around 8 a.m., and then the afternoon golfers kick off at 1 p.m. We have box lunches, and we have a great barbecue at the end. The great news is the great work that would not happen without this event. I mean, anyone involved in pro-life movement is always raising money in some way, and usually the results are less than what you hope for. But our golf marathon has been an exception. We've actually have done very well. It's been a real blessing. We do it every other year in odd years. And it funds both what I would call the patient and the urgent. I mean, we live in a culture where sexual promiscuity drives abortion and so many aspects of the culture of death. And in the mid-'80s, Molly Kelly led an effort to promote chastity education. There were 40-something age married women. And around the year 2000, 20-something single young men and women took over that great apostolate, and we called it Generation Life. And even as we speak, they're starting a Try to Redeem Senior Week down the shore for the next 2 weeks. They go around and evangelize on the beaches because Senior Week, well, any parent that has that concern, what goes on down there. Mm. But it's a good example of Generation Life all year round to try to promote the message of chastity, which is freedom. And it not only saves young people from abortion, but all the heartache of STDs and heartbreak, et cetera. Then the other is the patient, which our Pro-Life Foundation is involved in educating and changing attitudes and saving, they're also part of the urgent, saving children here and now. The abortion started, most women schedule their abortions through the Yellow Pages, but now it's through Internet search word campaigns. And our foundation has saved many hundreds of lives through local crisis pregnancy centers by buying time with search engines where if you, say, Google abortion Philadelphia, the Philadelphia Community Women's Center will come up before Planned Parenthood for a certain amount of time, depending how much money you spend. And that we've done these ads particularly with the Bucks County Community Women's Center in Bristol. So that's one of our main expenditures for, and I hope you get it. You and I are partners on our A Lady of Fatima at 100 conference. The foundation is providing money for that. So mm-hmm. It's a tremendous combination of the urgent and the patient that this fundraiser supports. So I hope your listeners would support us in some way. And everyone's welcome to come out and join us at the end of the day barbecue that begins at 5:30.
You know, these kids that come in from all over the country and world, in fact, and give a year or two of their lives in Gen Life are just remarkable. What's their agenda like? I know in the summer they do the senior week, as you say, but normally, what are they doing? Going into the high schools and just preaching chastity?
Well, I'll begin with the school year. In September, it's a big part is sharpen the sword, because back to school, there's not many talks there, but it's preparing for their mission. And a good part of their work is really reminding gatekeepers to get in. The Catholic, local Catholic schools are very sympathetic to Gen Life, but they're still humans, and they have to be reminded. Lots of emails and phone calls. But then they... But September is the probably one of the big traveling months, that in January and February, because we have a satellite apostolate in New York City schools, and then we're in most of the Catholic high schools. We're in some many private schools, even a few charter schools. We've even gotten into Philadelphia public schools through the back doors in the recent school year. And then there's specialty talks, whether we are next to the kids themselves, we try to reach parents through home and school presentations, and then through parish talks. So it's, and then there's outreach events, trying to get new people in, whether it's Friday night campfires. Just last August, our Northeast Philadelphia affiliate, led by Caitlin Adidamo, did a series of presentations each Thursday night at a local Northeast Philly restaurant, where about 70 to 80 young adults came, and they're mostly it's oriented toward the Catholic faith. So that's a sample of what they do, and it's they're busy all around. And then those who are missionaries, which you refer to, they spend after senior week for between late June to late August, they spend that time going back home to raise money. But another fundraiser we have for anyone going on vacation down to Avalon Stone Harbor the first Sunday in June, excuse me, first Sunday in August, the pastor of St. Brendan Navigator Parish has been very good to us. And we get to do presentations there to raise money, which typically raises $10,000 to $15,000. So that's a big event during the summer for Generation Life.
Mike, do you ever hear them talk about what we might loosely call success stories, meaning people that have come back to the young people come back to the faith, or young people that have come forward and asked questions, young people maybe that even want to get involved in the apostolate?
Definitely, and some of them are on the Generation Life website and on the Facebook page. They come both ways. The children, well, these are teenagers and young adults, repent and said, "I wish I had lived this before." But just like the Lord's parable, the woman caught in adultery, that it's never too late. Neither do we condemn you. It's everyone can redeem their sexuality, and on the other hand, that's part of the pushback is when you challenge someone's behavior, if they don't want to change, they find reasons to attack you personally. So my point there is that these young people who are in the classrooms and on the beach, they will face this pushback, and they're going to learn a lot of courage and strength of conviction to stand for the truth with love, and which is what this culture desperately needs.
How many are there of them now that are working?
We have four full-time and two part-time, and then for our beach outreach, they will bring in another 20 volunteers. These are recently graduate high school kids through young adults. Hmm. So that's and the Generation Life has a new president, Father Joseph Zaleski, who was a parochial vicar at St. Catherine's and got a satellite office right next to Father Judge High School, which has now become Gen Life's main office. So that's where they're headquartered at, and we still have the office in Westchester. So Generation Life continues to grow and succeed, though you only have to turn on the TV or the newspaper to see what we're up against in the culture. But truth has such power. And I brushed over quickly, but the sharpen the sword part is a big part of what they do, because they are continually face new challenges. If you would have told us a year or two ago that you're going to be asked, well, why can't I become a boy or girl if I'm the opposite biological gender? That's now the toughest question they face. I mean, 6 years ago, we spent a whole summer, several Thursdays, going over same-sex marriage, how to address that, and really got pretty good at it. And that's our junior presentation in high school. But now they're learning how to deal with gender dysphoria, both to speak the truth, but also with love. And the culture presents new challenges on this issue all the time.
Are they welcome in even Catholic schools talking about this sensitive issue today?
They are welcome, but I tell you, the good news is we've won the church over on abortion, the beginning of life issues, mm-hmm. but there's still a pushback, what I would call the Lavender Mafia. The Lavender Mafia is still a real presence in church and schools, where an original director, Kim Marshall, now Kim Savage, had a great line. It's called the Magic Air Syndrome, where someone who's hostile to your message takes something you say and then twists it to make it a personal attack and then tries to get you chased out. But if you went to our name, we've been banned from certain Catholic high schools in this area for a few years because of teaching the truth about homosexuality. It offended someone, and then gatekeepers get scared. But here's an example of the magic air syndrome. One of the advantages of living chastely is you're less likely to divorce. The verse saying promiscuity promotes divorce. And if you were to say that, a high school student whose parents are divorced would attack you, saying, well, you're criticizing my parents and me because they're divorced. Of course, we said nothing of the sort. But and that's when that gets to a gatekeeper. We got banned from here from a high school because of that. So that's the there are some weak-kneed gatekeepers, but it's overall we've done well getting back in. And but it is a constant challenge.
What do the kids say to you, the young people doing this work when they get attacked for proclaiming the truth, even in a Catholic setting?
They have mixed reactions. They're learning their scars. And that's a great question, Brian, because that's been one of my key roles. If ever you, a slight divergence, but it's right on point. A guy named Douglas Hyde wrote a book. He was a communist in Great Britain. And then he came out of the party, became a devout Catholic. But whenever you advocate for a cause, you're never going to get this new advocate to be perfectly articulate on your issues. You have to at some point send them out not totally equipped with the challenges. Because when they falter or say, I could have done this better, it creates a thirst in them to learn more. So that's overall the approach we follow with Generation Life. Our young adults are not perfect going out. They will stumble and say, man, I should have done this question better. But they come back and equip themselves. So and it develops courage, which you've heard me say this before in prior shows, contraception and cowardice are the root causes of the culture of death. So courage and chastity are the solutions. So sending them out in this hostile environment actually promotes courage, because it's a moral courage. And I think we've been pretty good at developing that in them, but it's a constant challenge. It's like a muscle. You got to constantly exercise it.
Well, the taking on of abortion is one thing, and we've frequently been disappointed that the church hasn't spoken together with a unified, fulsome voice at critical moments, national elections, etc. But taking on the issue of contraception, I mean, we know from Janet Smith's fine work that about 98% of Catholic couples contracept. How do the kids even hope to get a hearing on a subject like that?
Well, one of the biggest surprise we learned, these are the adults supervising, when they went in, when we started in the year 2000, was a surprisingly large number of high school girls on contraceptives for quote-unquote acne or for menstrual dysfunctions. Of course, it's medically totally unsound. And of course, we quickly read that the problem is their moms think they will not be chaste, so therefore contraception's a backup. But we have, these kids are hungry for that because they know the physical problems of oral contraceptives, the weight gain, the moodiness, the bloatedness. And when you show them, one of the best things, I'll claim credit for this, we took a package. Georgia Saudi gave us some packets of contraceptive drugs. We took the insert out because by law, chemical companies have to provide all the detailed harms of contraceptives. And we photocopied it. And this is part of our educational materials. And we show the kids, we say, look, don't believe us. Read Bar Pharmaceutical for yourself and see what it does to your body. And that gets their attention. And so I can't say we've won on that. But meanwhile, on the positive side, Barbara Rose has created some excellent education materials on what's called NAPRO, which is the way to deal with these menstrual problems without resort to artificial estrogen. And you combine with the truth of how you can deal with amenorrhea and dysmenorrhea without, and how it promotes actually infertility. The longer you're on oral contraceptives, the less likely you'll be able to have children. So it's a constant challenge, but at least it's a candle out there. That's what I'm saying to your listeners. You just turn on the news or any website, all the darkness, but these young adults are a candle, and I'm asking for your listeners' help to support us financially through this SCOF event. It's our main fundraiser, and I hope they'll help us out.
Mike, what are some of the other works that the foundation is involved in? You mentioned, of course, the Crisis Pregnancy Center, but I know you're involved in a lot of different things.
We are. We have we made a decision back in the late 90s that, to give in our financial resources. We at the time we averaged about $150,000 a year, and it goes up or down. But we're not going to make a dent in, with the TV airtime buys now. So we made a dent. We are going to be the startup engine for pro-life endeavors. That's one of our major things. And Gen Life is a great example. The Internet Search Word Ad campaign through Heroic Media. They were a partner on that. The other things we did was in 2015, we had a project called Philly Alive. We funded that. You were part of it, Brian. Thank you. You hired Christine Dickerson to create it's a painting of a child in the womb with the word mercy. Spent about $10,000 on signs and ads. And one of the signs we have, this ties into the other topic, what's going on in Harrisburg, are these signs. When you walk in our state capitol, you'll see numerous pro-life legislators that have these mercy signs in their windows declaring that they want mercy on the child in the womb.
Wow.
And they were a big part of our rally that we had on Tuesday, mercy. And you can explain to your listeners that the period is a big part of that whole thing. All the fruit that came out of Philly Alive was part of our foundation. We were the funding for that. And now, will probably be a later call, we're getting our act together for this Our Lady of Fatima conference. There's going to be seed money needed, and advertising. We'll fund that as well. We agreed in theory, our foundation did. We have to go back and appropriate the exact money.
Mm-hmm.
And the Bucks County Women's Center, which actually then became the Philadelphia Community Women's Center, we're working with a baby's breath now to try to open crisis pregnancy centers close to abortion committers. Not quite on point, but one of the fruits of the Bucks County Women's Center is it opened right across the street from Planned Parenthood headquarters in Bucks County. Well, guess what? That headquarters is now closed. It was one of the 30 PPs that closed in March,
isn't
two of which were in Pennsylvania. It's a resource, and occasionally we can afford a good radio ad campaign, but we just have to partner with national groups for the radio advertising.
Well, I know Baby's Breath, Pete Ross, and I think his dad too are involved with that. They're both Knights of the Immaculate, as you and I are. And I was up to take a look at the one they opened in, I think it's Phoenixville. I think it is. I may be wrong on that. In the fall, and it's a new work that Pete's been involved in. They have a golf outing, as a matter of fact. I forget the name of the course they play. My son's a member there. But that also is up off the ground and saving babies, saving lives.
Amen. Yeah, and there's many generous people. I mean, John Williamson gave a lot of money to that, and it's just to give a brief big picture reflection. George Grant is a Protestant Christian active in the pro-life movement who wrote a book in the late 90s called The Third Time Around. The point was, this is not the first time that Christians had to fight the culture of death and outlaw killing children in the womb. I mean, the early Christians in the Roman Empire had to do it, and then we in America did it beginning in the 19th century, in 1827, when the French physicians discovered contraception. We went around, it was mostly Presbyterians. The Catholic Church was an immigrant church. And beginning with Missouri in 1835, through Connecticut in 1882, Pennsylvania was 1860. Governor Packer, the street's named for him down there, the stadiums, outlawed abortion. And now we have to do it again. And George emphasized, whenever the church has succeeded, it's been a combination of patience and urgency. And the CPCs, the Christ Spring Centers, emphasize the urgent nature, as do protests at these facilities, but also the educational efforts of Generation Life and our foundation are in for a long-term patient campaign to change attitudes and behaviors.
Mike, you mentioned Harrisburg, and I wanted to touch on that before we finish up this first half hour. I know you've got to run, but tell us about Harrisburg. What was the agenda last week, and what was accomplished?
The agenda is summarized in the one word, mercy, which I mentioned previously. The specific legislative agenda was to restore Pennsylvania's leadership for pro-life legislation. I mean, Pennsylvania for many years, from right before Roe v. Wade until the early 90s when Steve Friend retired, was the leader. And in 1980, abortions peaked in Pennsylvania. There were 65,777. In 2015, they were down to 31,818, which is still that number too many. But most of the drop occurred because of what was done to change Pennsylvania law. This only where the battle to protect life will be won. And as our leader for many years, Steve Friend, often metaphored that it's like a 15-round TKO process. And we're only in the third round right now. It's a bloody knockdown, drive-out round. And right now we're trying to do two things. One, we want to become the 16th state to say we're not going to give our state money to Planned Parenthood anymore or any other abortion committers. That bill got out of the Senate committee. It's now Senator Pat Brown from Allentown is stalling that bill in the Senate Appropriations Committee. In fact, I just got a meeting with him on Wednesday. Some of us are going to visit him. And then the other bill is to ban dismemberment abortions and post-20-week gestation abortions. Right now, the law in PA bans post-24-week gestation abortions with certain exceptions. There's probably less than 50 a year with those exceptions. So it is a pretty tight law. But why not outlaw all abortions? Well, this is a step-by-step process because these are the laws on the cutting edge of upholding the court. I mean, if I already had a pro-life governor and president, we would tell the courts to go to hell. We're going to protect children no matter what. But that's because of court decisions. And right now, the lower court decisions are mixed on these issues. And we're trying to frame a case which will go back to the Supreme Court. We had a major setback in 2015 when a Texas law that required admitting privileges for abortionists was struck down. Anthony Kennedy went back to being pro-abortion. But we're hoping now with Gorsuch on the court, we'll do better. But even within the given framework of court decisions, there's a lot more Pennsylvania could do. And the reason we don't do more, Brian, the good news is we have almost 2-to-1 majorities in the Pennsylvania House and Senate. But we accomplished so very little because of cowardly Republican leaders in the state House and Senate. That's the bottom line. I wish I'm being candid. But part of the reason for the cowardice is us. You know, we pro-lifers are not on their case. We want to be nice rather than to be effective. I proudly claim the title of they call me a PIA. I prefer being called a pebble, but we have too many nice guys up there that accept crumbs from them when they should be giving us a full meal. Right. And I'll name names. I mean, the Speaker of the House, Mike Turzai, he wants to be our next governor, but he's doing very little. Senator Jay Corman, the Senate Majority Leader from State College, he's doing very little. I could go on and on right now. But it's on us too. So what we achieved was we instilled zeal in our legislators. We heard some amazing stories of there. We heard a tremendous rebuttal to the what one state senator, Lisa Baker, went on the floor and she opposed the bill. To ban post-20-week abortions. Mm-hmm. The argument for 20 to 24-week abortions is some prenatal conditions are not diagnosed till after 20 weeks, and therefore a mother is carrying a child which is either going to die shortly after birth or have disabilities. So they want the so-called right to kill their child that late. And she told her story where her child died shortly after birth. And therefore, her conclusion was, I should have been allowed to kill this baby before he was born. I mean, this is totally upside down. Well, a gentleman named Mark McNaughton, a former state rep, came up and told his and his wife's story. In 1993, he and his wife were diagnosed that their baby had hydrocephalus, which is almost always a death sentence, you know, water on the brain. Mm-hmm. If your child survives, Mark, he's going to be deaf, dumb, blind, you name it. The child was born perfectly healthy. They rejected abortion, but they kept a shunt in his head to drain fluid. And he was developing normally, but then the the shunt clogged, and their son Christian died very suddenly. But that wasn't the end of the story. He went on to say they donated his organs and saved the lives of three other children.
Oh my God!
So because of Mark and Denise McNaughton's decision for life, three children are alive today, even though they suffered the loss of their son Christian. But they have a clear conscience. They had him for 4 years.
Right.
And everyone was in tears hearing the story. The other witness we all had heard before, we heard a great, in fact, she's a colleague of yours, a talk show host, Christine Flowers. She's a woman in her early 50s, an attorney, who is actually liberal on many issues. She's an immigration attorney, but pro-life comes first for her. And she gave a great witness and urged us to use the right language. Then we heard Kirk Condrich, whose daughter is Chloe. We have a law name for her, Chloe Condrich. Back in 2014, Governor Corbett signed a law not to outlaw abortions on children with Down syndrome. I wish we could do that someday, but to provide resources to parents who have a prenatal diagnosis of Down syndrome. And he went through the startling statistics. In most countries, only 10% of children diagnosed with Down syndrome are born. They're allowed to be born. The parents have them killed beforehand. And Chloe was there, so we got to see what a great witness these children are. I mean, children with Downs are going right to heaven. It's it's just an amazing witness. So the rally was, the content was better than expectations. The attendance was up from last year, but we always want for more. We had 250 last year. We had 300 this year. We're going to do it again. This is going to be an annual part of the pro-life movement in Pennsylvania, and we're going to keep coming to legislators until they protect all women and children from abortion.
Did any of the legislators themselves show up?
They did, yes, very much so. And they were moving. Kathy Rapp is a leader of the Pro-Life Caucus. She gave a witness about her oldest sister was born with a disability. And even though Kathy was younger, she became her sister's protector because she was bullied and made fun of in school. And this developed her pro-life commitment. She went on how her sister became this great teacher. She has a physical disability. She was in Shriners Hospital. She has difficulty walking, but she's a beloved teacher for many years. And again, this would be the example that the other side would want us to kill in their 20th to 24th week of gestation.
Well, are any of these legislators like Kathy who come and listen and are part of it, are they able to convince a Mike Tirzal to step up and do what he's accountable for doing?
They're capable, but they underperform, to be candid. They don't know the strength they have. And if I could get them to do one thing, it would be have a half hour with Steve Friend. Steve Friend was able to get pro-abortion House Democratic and Republican leaders to run his pro-life legislation because he had a great combination of the carrot and the stick. You know, if you don't do what you say, I'm going to make a mess of your calendar. On the other hand, he had friends. He made friends across the aisle. I mean, Jim Mandarino was a Democrat, and yet he and Steve were great buds. And when the Democrats had the majority, Mandarino ran all Steve's pro-life legislation. Matt Ryan was in charge of the Republicans. He ran Steve's legislation, even though they clashed on some other issues. So they don't know their power that they have. And I'm the institutional memory right now. I'm only 64. But I'm the only one left that was there with Steve Friend, and actually Marty Mullen. I was at the tail end of Marty Mullen's leadership. And they look at me almost as if I'm Pollyannish to speak to them about all the things we used to accomplish. Because our pro-life reps, they elect their leaders. The leaders are accountable to them. They can unelect them, but they're afraid of them. It's fear, Brian, again. These pro-life leaders fear that their other legislation won't be run because their leaders won't like them. When actually human nature is the opposite. The more you stand up to them, the more they'll respect you. So our legislative leaders do not respect the leaders of the pro-life caucus right now. And that's the tension, and that's why we have these rallies, to urge them to stand up.
Well, Mike, I promised I'd let you go in a half hour. I'm very grateful that you came on. You really filled us in on this wonderful event, June 26th at Stonewall. Where can people get more information on it?
They can visit goprolife.org is the website for the GOF event.
Mm-hmm.
Call me at 215-393-3610. Or if you want more information, what's going on in Harrisburg, www.phillyalive.net is the website for what's going on in Harrisburg.
Mike, thanks for all you do. Thanks for coming on. Just wonderful to have you, and God love you and Seal.
Thank you, Brian. Thanks for your leadership and support.
All right, we're going to move on in just a minute to a commercial for In His Sign Network and our dear friend, Catherine. Kathleen McCarthy, I should say. Just want to mention Knights of the Immaculate, who's sponsoring the programs this month. You know all about St. Maximilian Kolbe, or at least you probably have heard of him. This network's about 40 years old, and it was consecrated to the Immaculate in Maximilian Kolbe's name at the beginning. And it's done great work under his patronage. He's the patron, as you probably know, of the communications arts, of the pro-life movement, of those suffering from depression, because he had those types of problems. One of the most remarkable men of the 20th century, so much so that John Paul II himself said he thought privately, he said this to one of our knights, Father James McCurry, a founder, he said he thought one of the reasons that he was elevated to the papacy was to make the work of the great St. Maximilian Father, he called him Father Maximilian Kolbe, better known among men. And of course, he was the man, John Paul II, who canonized the great St. Maximilian Kolbe. So the Knights of the Immaculate are a group of men and women, actually. We make consecrations of our lives, our work, our families, any apostolic work we do, our earthly pilgrimages, everything that we possess and own. We deed it over to the great Immaculate Woman, and she uses it as she sees fit, as Max said, only and always to please her son, because she know what pleases her son. And so she is the great lady. She's the woman of Revelation 12. She's the Lady of Fatima. She is the Immaculate One, conceived without sin, and the great advocate, the great intercessor for mankind. And St. Maximilian Kolbe, in our age, the 20th century, made Marian consecration a staple of Catholic devotional life. And for any of you that are interested in it, I wish you'd call. We'd love to have you. Ask questions about it here on air at 610-527-2906, or even off air, call and we'll get information to you. But now let's hear from Kathleen McCarthy and her wonderful network.
Hello, Father DeLacy here, and I owe a great debt of gratitude to the In His Sign radio ministry. It was this radio ministry that I listened to when I was going from being a lukewarm Catholic to an engaged Catholic, and this ministry really majorly affected the Catholic that I am today. Kathleen McCarthy in particular has an uncanny ability to speak to the heart, and when she speaks to the heart, she speaks with God's love, with His grace, and with His mercy. I can honestly say that I am a better Catholic, a better man of God, and have experienced the healing and joy of the gospel because of the great ministry of Kathleen McCarthy. And so I encourage others to listen to her so that they can experience the beautiful work that God does through her beautiful words.
You're listening to In His Sign Catholic Radio, empowered by the Holy Spirit, bringing the fire of God's love to the world. We are blessed to have had this Catholic radio apostolate for almost 40 years now. Thanks be to God for your partnership. Without you, this radio voice would be silenced. We have a monthly Mass offered for you, our loyal family of listeners. It's our way of saying thank you for underpinning our apostolate with your many prayers and financial support. This is your radio ministry, to be a voice for those who have no voice, to evangelize and to catechize for a time such as this. We know the Lord will bless you abundantly. He can never be outdone in generosity. If this ministry has touched your heart, help us to touch other hearts by supporting us with your prayers and financial support. Call us at 610 527-2906 or visit our website at inhissign.com.
Hi, we're back again. This is Brian Gale. Our recourse, Monday, 4 to 5 o'clock, WTAM, I believe it is, 800 a.m. out of Camden. And I commend, again, Kathleen McCarthy's great work and this wonderful network to your prayers and your generosity. She is truly a wonderful, wonderful lady doing very important work. On the back end of this show, I want to talk to you a little bit about a great book that is just out. It's Paul Kenger's book, and it is called The Pope and the President. It's about 600 pages long with an additional 90 pages of notes. And it's a really exhaustive look at the friendship behind the scenes, unspoken, untalked about, unrecorded in some cases, between John Paul II, the St. John Paul II, and President Ronald Reagan, and what they accomplished together in the 1980s. And it really develops that they had this friendship that nobody really knew much about. After President Reagan died, his wife, Nancy Reagan, told Paul Kenger, the author, that Ronnie, I'm quoting her, as he did, Ronnie considered John Paul II his closest friend. And as I read that, I was just astonished. And from the other side, came equal testimonies. Now Cardinal Dievish used to be, I guess he was a Monsignor at the time when he worked with John Paul II in the Vatican some 30, 35 years ago. But he said, too, they were kindred spirits. They understood that they had been called to a mission, that they had to be tested first, that each one was tested very near death, not commonly known how close Ronald Reagan was to death. John Paul II, we know, could have been, I think it was 1 millimeter, something like that, between where the bullet landed and where it could have landed that would have killed him, probably within an hour. And both men understood that they had been saved and that God had a mission for them and that they were called to that mission from different perspectives. John Paul II, obviously, from the great moral and mystical, if you will, dimension, but Ronald Reagan from the temporal and the very practical and geopolitical. And together they worked, and they communicated often by phone conversations that were on secured lines, by mail pouches, by cable. They met a number of times. They met times that were not even recorded. This man spent about 16 years working on the book, Paul Kenger, and he talks about how he tracked down people that worked with Reagan and people who worked with people who worked with Reagan and was able to verify a lot of information about meetings they had that the world did not know of. And one of the more remarkable stories in the book is the story about Ronald Reagan's famous trip to Germany. It was a place called Bitburg. It was a cemetery. And there were many of our GIs who had survived the D-Day landing who were buried there, and he went to pay tribute to them. And Helmut Kohl, the Prime Minister of Germany, invited him, and it came out afterward that there were Nazis that were buried there as well. And so a fury was whipped up, and there was great pressure on Ronald Reagan not to go. But Ronald Reagan, being who he was, he went. He said, "I promised Helmut Kohl and the Germans that I would go. I'm going." And he gave a magnificent talk, and the press went apoplectic that he went. And in his talk, of course, he talked about God. The man was deeply prayerful, as we'll see. But what was not reported was on the way back, doesn't he make a stop in a place called Fatima, Portugal? And doesn't he address the parliament in Fatima, Portugal? And aren't there some 80, 90 men and women there? And they have headsets on, and they're listening to him. And he's talking about the impact of Fatima and what happened there in 1917. it develops that John Paul II had given him a book, had talked to him about Fatima, and had told him that for you to understand the way I look at East-West relations and really this time in salvation history, very important that you understand Fatima and what happened at Fatima and what Our Lady had to say about atheistic communism and the errors that would spread and nations that would be annihilated and that there would be a pope who would suffer much. He didn't go any further than that. It was clear. But didn't Ronald Reagan, in the course of that address, magnificent, at his rhetorical best, and that's saying something, he says at one point, you know, the prayers of those three small children had more power than all the armies of the world. And when he said it, apparently, according to Kenger, the heads of these parliamentarians jerked back. They looked at each other. They took their headphones off. They were gesticulating one to another. Did we hear, did this president of the United States just, he's a Protestant, did he just say what we thought he said? And he did say it, and he believed it. And he was a great believer in Fatima. And why do we make the point? Because Fatima, of course, is, this is the 100th, this is the centennial year, the anniversary of the 100-year anniversary of the Fatima apparitions, six of them from May 13 through October 13. And John Paul II believed that they were the most decisive, mystical event, if you would call it, supernatural event since the resurrection. Nothing equaled it. As you know the story, three young children, Our Lady appears, actually the archangel appears first, Michael, and tells them, warns them that of what's to come. And the children are at the appointed place, the appointed hour, noon, May 13, 1917. And the great lady appears. And the first thing she says to them, she sees that they're frightened. She says, please, don't be afraid. You know, I've come to help you. And from there, of course, they know suffering. They're tested. It's the way of things, isn't it? When God approaches man, there's always suffering. But what comes out of it, of course, is beyond blessed, beyond joyful, beyond anything that man could ever appreciate or envision. And out of it comes this great warning that man really must turn back. This is, of course, during the middle of the First World War. It's really on the cusp of the Second World War because it would be triggered by an atheistic communism and the Bolshevik Revolution that happened only a couple of weeks, I think, after the last apparition. And here Our Lady talks about the formula, you know, that man must pray, man must repent, man must turn back. The children are shown a vision of hell. We have souls falling into hell like leaves in the autumn, falling off trees, according to one of the children. And Our Lady told the children, well, those are the souls that go to hell, that fall into hell because they have no one to pray for them. And then, of course, each of the two children who died within a year or so of the Black Plague began to take on a lot of suffering, particularly little Jacinta. Horrific suffering, and she dedicated herself to reparative suffering for the rest of her life. The little child was 10 or 11 years old, I think, when she died, so it lasted another year and a half or two, but it was really awful suffering, and she was quite joyful in it because she got the fact at that age that suffering had a power all unto itself if it was consecrated, and she knew what Our Lady was asking her to do, and all of us to do, and all of the people of that age to do. And she was going to do it, and she did it. And Our Lady, of course, as some of you know, promised a great sign would appear in the sky. And when that sign appears, you will know that the Second World War, which will happen during the papacy of Pope Pius XI, if you can believe it, she actually named the Pope at the time. And in 1939, the great sign appeared. They thought it was the Aurora Borealis, but it turns out it really was not. It was something distinctly of its own phenomenological nature. And within a month, I think, the Nazi tanks rolled into Czechoslovakia, Poland, and then, of course, the war was on. It was engaged. 60 million people died. Nations were annihilated. But the suffering of the Pope had to await some period after that. It wasn't until May 13, if you can believe it, the very same day, 4 years later, 1981, that John Paul II, of course, was all but assassinated. The Soviet government, the book makes clear, Andropov, who became the premier after Chernenko, he was the one before Gorbachev took over. He gave the world the word through his military unit, the GRU, to work with the Bulgarians and their version of KGB to hire an assassin and an accompaniment of three or four others who would make sure the assassin himself never made it out of St. Peter's Square alive, to assassinate the Pope. And all of that is a matter of record, historical record. People did not want to acknowledge it. The CIA in America didn't want to acknowledge it. Even many in the Vatican did not want it to be acknowledged. But John Paul II understood it. And the American CIA, Bill Casey, working under Reagan, and his directive, made sure that they understood and drew the connection, connected the dots. And atheistic Russia, as Our Lady said in Fatima in 1917, would make the Pope suffer much. He was laid up for about a year. He studied Fatima and the apparitions in a way he never had before. He came to understand that he was the Pope that would be bloodied in white in St. Peter's Square on that fateful day. Really 64, as we say, 64 years to the hour. So what happens? A year to the hour later, day and hour later, 1 year, he goes back to Fatima. He takes the bullet that almost killed him, very nearly killed him. Miraculously, he escaped, as he put it. The would-be assassin fired the bullet, pulled the trigger, but the Immaculate Mother of God guided the bullet just enough away from his aorta that he might live and survive and be prepared, therefore, for the great work that he had been called to, which was ending communism with his American president, Protestant American president. But he goes to the Cove a year later, and he takes the bullet, puts it in the crown, puts the crown on top of Our Lady's head in the Cove, and says, "I declare the message of Fatima more urgent than ever." Now, that's 82, okay? So that's 35 years ago, a couple weeks ago, right? We're 35 years and several weeks removed from that event, him declaring the message of Fatima more urgent than ever. And one of the things that the book makes clear is that in every generation, men have to fight off the prince of the powers and principalities here on earth, the one that was dispatched from heaven because of his virulent pride. Of course, I'm talking about Satan. But that it's possible for that to be done if the generations will rise up. When they don't, they're vanquished. But when they do, they plug into this extraordinary power that the Immaculate herself diffuses and focuses, because as St. Max said, she's the bridge. That's the way God set it up, that all grace, all power from the Trinity would flow Father to Son through the Holy Spirit into mankind through the Immaculate Woman and back, because what goes out must come back, just like the Word, so too the Force, so too the Spirit. And because she has that unique relationship with the Holy Spirit, Our Lady is able to mediate that and become, of course, one of the great advocates. She's a co-redemptrix in a very real sense, not 50%, 50%, not 50-50, but because of who she was, what she did, and what she continues to do, she also is a partner in the great redemptive act of her Son. So she understood exactly what was at stake in the 20th century. She knew what would happen if man did not turn back. She knew that there would be a worse war. If there were about 20 million killed in the first, there's 60 in the second. That's three times as many. And the message, he says, is still very, very urgent. And I must say, as I look around and I ask you who are listening, seems to be reasonably true, doesn't it? I mean, here we are wildly distracted by vapor, by ether, here domestically about what was said, what wasn't said. What is collusion? What is deception? All these domestic things that really are nothing but a great but transparent demonic distraction. so that we will not focus on the great issues at hand, the cultural renewal that is the source of any nation's strength built around the family, will not deal with the great trade issues, the economic issues, and so the debt threatens to bury us as we're unable to pay back the debt in any way. And the money would then be inflated away, and people would not be prepared to make to handle that in our time. They just wouldn't. $20 trillion's little much. But beyond that, all the geopolitical issues. You know, the problem with North Korea, nuclear war. I mean, our generals and our president are very, very clear about what's at stake. Everybody agrees that the can's been kicked down the road as far as it can. We have, of course, China trying to appropriate the South China Sea, and our Secretary of Defense, General Mattis, saying, not going to let you do it. I don't know what that means, but not going to let you do it. You have Iran in a great civil war with its Sunni tribesmen, hopefully, in their mind, bringing about Armageddon so that the 12th imam will return. And that is all to the good as far as they're concerned. So you have all of that focus on the part of Iran and their terrorist cabal on Israel. And we know Israel will play a significant event at the end of time, has to, because we know our Lord will return to this age and this time, whenever it is. At the end of the age, when the Israelis, are his Jewish brothers and sisters, when they fall to their knees and beg for the Messiah, and God will hear their call. Roy Shoman makes that beautifully clear in his wonderful book, Salvation is from the Jews. Was the first time, and the salvation of the Jews will be again when our dear Lord returns. We believe for the second time, they will accept only that it is for the first time. But we have all these things going on, not to mention Russia, which was consecrated in 1984, and a lot of dispute about whether or not the formula John Paul II used was entirely accurate or not, because it didn't specify or mention Russia particularly. But Lucia said it did, and we would think she had some knowledge of that. And of course, there's a lot of speculation that she had continued apparitions in her cloistered monastery well beyond 1917, and even some speculation in Paul Kenger's book that her response to John Paul II and others who wondered if the consecration had been made in 84, March 25, 84, in the correct formula, appeared to await Our Lady's approbation of it. We're reading into things a little bit, at least the author is. I'm reporting it secondhand, don't know one way or another. But nonetheless, what happens 2 weeks ago? Cardinal Raymond Burke calls for a formal consecration of Russia. Formal, 2017, 100 years later. Bishop Athanasius Schneider from East Asia also calls for a formal consecration of Russia. So the issue is still somewhat alive, I think you'd have to say. When they're calling for it, I mean they're asking the Pope to do it. Whether Pope Francis will do it or not, I mean, who knows? But the fact that the matter remains that Fatima is still very much alive in this 100th year, 100 years after this extraordinary supernatural event, the sun falling from the sky, appearing to tumble right into a crowd of about 70,000 people, frightening them near to death, and 3 days of rain drying up in moments, and people going home flabbergasted, just unable to even talk about what they had just seen. Great newspapers in Europe writing about it. An event that's 100 years old, and yet, as we're saying, very current, very much current. And I'd be remiss if I didn't point out that within 72 hours of Fatima's final apparition, doesn't this priest, Father Maximilian Kolbe, see the Freemasons running through Rome? He's not aware of anything that happened in Fatima. They don't have CNN or MSNBC or Fox News or anything else. He has no idea that Our Lady appeared at Fatima. May not have even known till the end of his life, short life. But he sees these Masons, Freemasonry. It's the 300th anniversary of Freemasonry, by the way. this year, running through Rome with placards calling for the overthrow and the death of the Pope. One of them says, we will command the Vatican in the year 2017. Let me repeat that. One of the signs, Colby said, is we the Freemasons, will command the Vatican in the year 2017. In other words, 100 years later. We'll need 100 years, but we'll get it done. What is Colby's response? He gathers, I think, 9 or 10 other friars, priests, and seminarians, and they go into a room in Rome, and they found the Knights of the Immaculate. And he is asked why, and he said, it is founded, the Knights of the Immaculate exist, to ultimately defeat Freemasonry and its evil designs. It is the locus of evil in our time. These times are dominated by evil, no doubt, no question. But at the end of this age, end of this period, meaning our time, much, much more so. And the way it will be done is through Marian consecration. We will consecrate every living soul that we can entice and invite to do so. And through their consecration of their lives, their entire lives, their work, their faith, their families, all of that, one by one, one soul by one soul, one family by one family, one parish, one diocese, one country, one sovereign block at a time, continent, we will ultimately usher in the triumph of the Immaculate Heart. And through that, of course, the reign of the Sacred Heart. So that was Colby's vision, and it happened within 72 hours of the final apparition at Fatima, and Freemasonry, of course, was very much involved in the Bolshevik Revolution that happened right around that same moment, as it was involved in the French Revolution, as it was, of course, in our own sexual and cultural revolution. So Freemasonry, the hydra-headed subterranean monster that works below the surface quite effectively, brilliantly, as several 32, 33rd degree Masons who have left have come out, and they've written books about it. They've been interviewed about it. You don't read much about it. You don't hear much about it. But to say the name St. Maximian Colby is to acknowledge what 11 or 12 popes have made clear, and that is that Freemasonry is the great evil of our time. And they have written encyclicals. All you have to do is Google it, and you'll see 11 or 12 popes have written great encyclicals about Freemason. And just a month or so ago, Pope Francis told Cardinal Burke to get rid of the Freemasonries in the Knights of Malta. I'm not making this up. This was 2 months ago. You can go back and Google it. So he's very much aware. So here we have the Knights of the Immaculate. We have Freemasons, and we have Fatima. And all of this 100 years later. And you get the sense that this is very much a time of momentous event in salvation history. So I just want to commend all of that for your thinking and your prayer. It is a wonderful time. It is a great time to be alive. We're called to consecrate ourselves to the Immaculate. The victory will be hers. It is promised. It's promised in Revelation, and we can be a part of it. I ask you all, please, to pray for Kathleen McCarthy and in his sign network, to pray for our recourse and for the Knights of the Immaculate and all the wonderful people in the pro-life movement like Mike McMonagle, who are doing such great work. And hope to see you back next week. Please have a good week and stay cool if you can.
Thank you for tuning in to Our Recourse. We are grateful to